I'm here with Anita Shreve, author of novels including Light on Snow, Body Surfing and The Pilot's Wife. Anita, your novels often concern themselves with ordinary people dealing with extraordinary events. Can you tell us about the catastrophe at the heart of your new novel, Testimony?
Yes, it involves a scandal that takes place at a private school in Vermont, and it involves underage drinking and sex, and there are three senior boys who are aged 18 and 18 who are involved in a sexual escapade with a freshman who is 14 years old. And the what makes this slightly unusual and brings it to the attention of other people, including the headmaster, who wishes he never knew about this, is that it's taped. It's photographed on video, and that tape makes its way to the headmaster, and he then has to deal with it. And it becomes a scandal that ripples out, not just from the students, but the parents become deeply involved in the other students and teachers, and then it actually spreads into the small community as they begin to take sides.
Mm. A sex scandal caught on camera at an elite boarding school. It sounds like every tabloid's dream.
Yeah.
Were you inspired by real life? Where did this idea come from?
Well, it was in the air. There had been a number of scandals, both at universities and at private schools, having to do with this. In each case, there had not been a camera, but there had been accusations of rape.
Mm. And you tell the story from, I think, at least 20 different perspectives. Did you always intend to do it that way, or did it come about in the process of writing?
It came about in the process of writing because I originally intended the headmaster to tell the entire story. The book starts 2 years after the scandal, but then I realized that he couldn't be privy to so much, and it would be a much richer book if we heard from each of the people. And I really used as the model As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, which is a novel about a family taking their mother to be buried. It's a journey, and they each get to say their piece. And this is... this was sort of how I saw this book.
I think I said earlier that your novels often have ordinary people dealing with catastrophic events. Mm. For example, mm. there's the widow who finds her husband's got another family,
right.
That sort of thing. What is it, do you think, that draws you to putting people in the middle of these situations?
Well, it's a wonderful place to put a character, for one thing. Either that character is going to take a risk with unintended consequences, or a character like Catherine in The Pilot's Wife, or like Jean in Weight of Water. I think there's actually a sentence in one of those novels that says, if you take a woman and push her to the edge, how will she behave? And obviously that applies to men too, and there are many men in this book.
Mm. And would you say that your novels often have quite a dark side to them, a pessimistic side?
They do, yes. you know, there's a glimmer of hope in a number of them, and that's really the best I can do.
You're not drawn to writing cheery chick lit, then? It's
No. And I think I'm probably incapable of writing a comedic sentence.
As a mother yourself, did you identify with the parents of the young boys in the book?
Yes, very much. I've had children go through high school and into college, and I think underage drinking is, and I'm talking about 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds. I think it's the biggest problem facing half a generation, and they're binge drinking and they're upping the ante the older they get, so that by the time they get to college, it's really dangerous and it's really out of hand.
Mm. And in the book, these are good boys who make yeah. a mistake, something goes wrong. I guess it's every mother's nightmare.
It is. And one of the mothers is really, she is the good mother who has really done her best. And Rob is just a wonderful boy from all accounts. And he was there and he participated. Michelle, who's the mother of J-Dot, the postgraduate student, he's a little dicier, I think. I think he's, you know, he's kind of a ringleader. He is, you know, able to procure the alcohol, and, you know, he has ideas beyond what the other boys might have had. This is from the voice of Ellen, who is the mother of one of the boys involved in the scandal. You wait for the call in the night. You've waited for years. You've imagined the voice at the other end, officious and male, always male. You hear the words, but you can't form the sentences. It's bad luck to form the sentences, so you skip to the moment when you're standing by the phone and you've already heard the news and you wonder, how will I behave? Will you scream? It seems unlikely. You are not a screamer. You can't remember the last time you screamed out loud. Will you collapse then, knees buckling, holding on to the wall as you go down? Or will you, as you suspect, simply freeze? The paralysis immediate and absolute, likely to last for hours. Because to move is to have to make a life after the phone call, and you can't possibly imagine how you will do that. But the call doesn't come in the middle of the night. It comes at 10:30 on a Wednesday morning. You're rushing out the door because you're headed to the dermatologist for a routine appointment. You've taken a personal day off from work so that you can fit all of your doctor's appointments into one day. You've already been to the dentist, and after this next visit, you will head to the gynecologist. It takes 35 minutes to get to the dermatologist's office. The appointment is at 11, and Dr. Carmichael is remarkably punctual. Your son is a million miles away from your thoughts just then, safely tucked away in a school in Vermont, cosseted by people for whom you have come to have enormous respect and with whom you have happily entrusted him. You have your keys in your hand, your coat is on, it's freezing outside, it has been for weeks, and the counter is a mess, but that's all right because you'll have time to put away the junk mail and the cereal bowl and the carton of orange juice when you get home. And so you think that maybe you should just let this one go, let the machine take it. But then you wonder, what if it's Dr. Carmichael's office and she's canceling and I'll have driven all that way for nothing, and so you pick up the phone. At first when you hear the voice, yes, male, yes, officious, you think to yourself that you've gotten off lightly, that this was your phone call and your child didn't die on a highway, and perhaps your voice is a bit too relieved. But then there is an awkward pause at the other end of the line, after which you actually hear all the words that don't belong in your universe, words from which you have gone to great lengths to isolate yourself. Your son has been involved in a major rule violation of a sexual nature. You say, I don't, and it's not possible, and I don't understand.
So before you were a journalist, you were a teacher. Yes. Was becoming a writer always the long-term plan? Were you writing while you were doing those other jobs?
It didn't really until the fifth year I was teaching, and then I had this sudden panicky feeling that I needed to start. I quit in the middle of the year teaching, which from the point of view of a parent now sounds appalling, but that's what I did. And I started writing short stories, and of course, you know, you can't make a living writing short stories. And so then I was able to figure out a way to be a journalist and to combine, you know, I was able to write, not in the way I wanted to, but I was able to write.
What sort of things were you writing as a journalist?
Well, in the beginning, anybody who would give me an assignment. You know, I remember writing an article about men's white shirts for the sex appeal of men's white shirts for Cosmopolitan, and I wrote boating articles for motorboating and sailing, and eventually I wrote for, you know, more and more serious magazines. Mm. I wrote a number of cover stories for the New York Times and for New York Magazine.
And you're obviously quite prolific if you're producing maybe, is it a book a year at the moment?
Not really, it's kind of a lot of these most recent books were really started about 5 years ago and stayed in desk drawers. So I think the average would be about 18 months.
Mm. Can you talk a bit about your writing process, how you go about it, where you do it?
I write every morning pretty much from about 7:30 to 12. I write in my bathrobe. I go directly from my cup of coffee to my office. I've learned the hard way that anything written after 12 noon is probably not worth keeping. I'm positive I've never written a word after 5 o'clock at night. It was a schedule, a routine that came about because I was a mother and I had kids who went to school, and I had to take advantage of the time that they were away. So the minute the last one was out the door, I was at my desk. Mm. And it's just a routine that stayed.
And do you use a computer? Do you write longhand?
I write by hand in notebooks, and then I will translate it onto a computer. And, you know, then print it out, edit by hand, put it on the computer. It's a very long process, and I'm very jealous of writers who can write in the computer.
Mm. I wanted to ask you as well about, you may have seen the comments from one of the judges of the the Nobel Prize for Literature, who described American writing as insular and isolated and ignorant. I wanted to hear what you thought about that.
Well, I think it's nuts, obviously. I think it's crazy. I think Americans in general are insular. So I see that they have a point in a way, but I think most writers are writing within their own nationality. I think it's the very rare writer who transcends that. And I just think it's too bad for American writers.
Mm. Any particular influences on your work? Any writers that you particularly admire that you think have contributed to your own writing?
Well, to my literary point of view, I mean, I guess I have to point the finger at Eugene O'Neill. When I was very young, early in high school, I read everything Eugene O'Neill wrote. It's hard to say which came first, the chicken or the egg, whether I was drawn to him because I already had this sort of bleak worldview. not in my life, by the way, but in my literary life. And you know, I think that it had something to do with how I saw how stories needed to be told. Mm. And so I guess we could point the finger at him. Mm. But I've long gotten over my Eugene O'Neill period. I recently saw A Long Day's Journey Into Night, which was my favorite play until I went to see, I've seen it before, but I recently went to see it. And it's I've forgotten how long a play it was. And the whole third act, it was like, get me out of here. So I think I'm over that phase of my life. Yeah.
So you're in the middle of your Europe tour at the moment to promote Testimony. What's next?
Well, it's not out in the States yet, so I go home. I have a week off, and then I go home to the American tour. And that's going to be a little tough because, you know, touring London, Dublin, Paris is a lot more interesting than Phoenix, Dallas, Indianapolis. So, but at least I can get nonstop news about the election, you know, it's harder to come by here.
Mm, mm. Well, Anise Shuve, I hope it all goes very well, and thanks very much for talking to us.
You're welcome.